Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 1st of December, 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, and Phil Bishop, both from the Construction Index. Seems like ages since we last spoke, Phil, but it's only 2 weeks. What have you been up to?
I know, well, we've gone fortnightly without telling anyone, haven't we? We should have announced this and said to people.
I think we mentioned it briefly last time, yeah.
But we're now fortnightly. Last 2 weeks, right. I can't remember. I've contrived to contract the mother of all head colds. I'm testing negative on COVID tests that I'm doing so far, but bunged up. But soldier on, keep going.
Good. Well, thank goodness for Zoom. That's all I can say.
Yes.
You don't have to share the same room.
More than arm's length away. Yes. But as far as the construction industry is concerned, it's been quite a busy period with one thing and another. I mean, we could talk at length about the Lange O'Rourke succession plan and what's happening there. That's all very interesting. And we could talk at length about the logjam in product testing.
Oh, product testing, yes.
The movement from CE marking to UKCA, product certification, which the Construction Leadership Council has said is all a bit bunged up. There's not enough testing going on. And it's already been put back a year to the forthcoming January. And they're now saying, look, we're still nowhere near ready. It's a nightmare.
I'm not really surprised, though. I mean, this isn't just construction products. It's everything, isn't it? You know, everything which used to be CE marked now has to be UKC. Is it UKCA?
CA, marked? Yes.
Yeah. Indeed. I mean, you know, that's an awful lot of products.
I mean, it strikes me that if they say that the UK mark is equivalent to CE mark, then for a period of time, why don't they just say, yeah, CE mark means the same thing?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how quick the how long or short the window is, because it's effectively the product still giving the same product, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. But as you say, they've already delayed it once. I think the CE mark is still valid until the end of next year. I think that's the new deadline.
It was originally supposed to the switchover was supposed to be the beginning of January 2022, and now it's going to be January 2023.
Yeah, a lot of testing going on, I assume. Yeah, go on.
We said we've got a lot to get in, so we said we weren't particularly going to talk about that. What I would like to talk about is a subject we've talked about before, and I seem to be the only person that feels strongly against it. Well, that's not entirely true. I know the National Federation of Builders have spoken out against it, but the proposal that builders engaged in domestic building work in the sort of the consumer end of the thing rather than the business-to-business side of things, there's a campaign that says they should have to have a licence to trade to show that they are A, competent, and B, not crooks and cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spoken and written before why I think this is a stupid idea. And it seemed like the Federation of Master Builders, who are the prime movers behind this campaign, had sort of realised that they were pushing water uphill on this one and slightly closed things down and said, all right, we're going to swing behind the Trustmark. We're going to try and make the Trustmark badge something that should be mandatory or at least should be recognised much more by consumers as something that they should expect their builders to have. Anyway, I was then surprised to see that this MP, Mark Garnier, who has achieved a certain celebrity in the past year or so for colourful language. Anyway, Mark Garnier introduced a private members bill, the Domestic Building Works Consumer Protection Bill, to implement a builder's licensing scheme, exactly along the lines that the Federation of Master Builders have been campaigning for.
Yeah.
Anyway, the second reading took place on the 19th of November, a couple of weeks ago now, and he spoke at modest length about why it was needed and all the usual arguments that too many builders are crooks and crooked and incompetent and giving them a license would suddenly make all builders much more competent and
trustworthy,
exactly. And then the relevant minister of the moment stood up and said, nah, Lee Rowley, he's construction minister, member. He basically said, nah. He says, we understand that there's an issue with consumers being, you know, ripped off by dodgy builders. But essentially, he said that the an across-the-board mandatory licensing scheme was disproportionate. It's about balancing how we protect the consumer and protect and support individual agency with markets that have sufficient information and knowledge in them so that people can make decisions without needing other organisations, groups or the state to intervene. So essentially it's an argument of state intervention against big brother, big state. And surprisingly, the Conservative government is going for small government. It's about the only thing that's come out in, you know, against big state in the past few years.
That wasn't exactly your argument against it. Your argument, if I remember correctly, was a little bit more to do with freedom. It seems to me that, well, I suppose it is the same.
It's same argument.
It is the same.
Not only freedom, but also, I think it's the wrong solution. I don't think it will fix anything. But having a license won't mean that you're necessarily competent. I mean, it's not like a CCCS card, Construction Skills Certification Scheme card, where you'll have your work inspected. Well, maybe you will have your work inspected, and there'd be an entire bureaucracy of testing centres, and you've got to go, you know, someone's got to come and watch you lay some bricks or dig a hole or whatever. And even if it does sort out, you know, everyone who's involved in the building industry has to have an NVQ or some sort of technical qualification in building, even if it does that, it doesn't mean to say that they're not going to be crooks and charlatans out there. Competence is not the same thing as crookedness. And a license, there are plenty of crooks and thieves out there with driving licenses, and they're still allowed to drive on the road. But, you know, I mean, having a license to drive a car doesn't stop them being crooks and thieves. I don't know. I think the bureaucracy implied by this is overwhelming. We said before, you know, what is building work? Now, okay, the Federation of Master Builders have done a lot of work on this, and they have come out to define it, saying anything that alters the structure. So hanging up a dado rail or a picture frame or something, or, you know, putting a screw in the wall, or putting in a cap flap, I don't think would qualify. You can still get Uncle John to do that on the side, but having a conservatory fitted or an extension, but I mean, how stupid have you got to be to get a 20-30 grand extension built without checking the competence of the person that's doing it?
I don't know. I think probably quite a lot of people do that. Lowest price, you know, bloke round the corner recommended to you, you know, or...
Okay, well, that leads on to, and this is another FMB campaign, which I'm fully aligned on. We've talked about this before. The reason why many of the less professional operations or less competent operations are cheaper is because they're small outfits who don't meet the one-man bands who don't meet the VAT threshold. They don't turn over enough revenue to have to pay VAT, and that makes them immediately 20% cheaper. Now, if I could go to my local FMB, limited company, building company, who is putting up 50 grand extensions, 30 of them a year, and they were brilliant, and if they were going to be the same price as the one-man band, it would be a win for me, the consumer, a win for the builder, a win for everyone all round. So the answer to me is not a builder's license. It's get rid of VAT on building improvements.
Which is a long-standing debate, isn't it? It's been going on for as long as I can remember.
Yeah,
but presumably the Treasury doesn't want to get rid of its income stream. So presumably that's one of the reasons why it hasn't happened.
Anyway, Mark Garnier's private members' bill fell at the very first hurdle. It was a second reading debate, and when the minister said, "We don't back it. It's not going to happen. Not on our watch." He said, "All right, I'll withdraw it. I'll go home."
Yeah, I suppose that's how it works, I guess.
There's another piece of legislation.
There is indeed.
We want to talk about draft proposed legislation, I should say.
Yes, indeed.
With our guest this week.
Well, let's introduce our guest. He's Alistair Bruce, better known as Lord Aberdare, a crossbench peer in the House of Lords, and a notable advocate for the reform of payment practices in the construction industry. A few weeks ago, Lord Aberdare tabled a private members' bill in the House proposing new legislation to outlaw the use of retentions in the construction industry. It's a topic that we've discussed before on the podcast, as regular listeners will know. And he joins us here today to talk about the bill and the whole thorny issue of retention. So welcome to Reconstruction, Lord Aberdare.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So your bill, to give it its correct title, full title, it's the Construction Brackets Retentions Abolition Bill, had its first reading in the House of Lords back in October, at the end of October. Can you just tell us a little bit about what the legislation is that you are proposing with the bill, and how this all came about?
Absolutely. Well, the legislation is extremely simple. It really does very little more than ban retentions from the 1st of January 2025. And just going right back to the other part of your question, how it all came about, really in a very serendipitous way, I think I just got an email about retentions in about 2015. At the time of the Enterprise, what is now the Enterprise Act of that year, explaining the issue to me. I had, before joining the House of Lords, run a number of small businesses, so I was very aware of the huge importance of cash flow and prompt payments. And it just seemed to me to be fundamentally unfair that small contractors in the construction sector were not only not receiving the full amounts due to them on completion of contracts, but in many cases were suffering long delays through retentions, or indeed losing that money altogether when the contractor who owed the retentions to them went bust. So I sort of I agreed to put down an amendment to the Enterprise Bill, as it was when it was going through the Lords, with the result that the then minister made a commitment to conduct a review of the practice of retentions. And, and to avoid going on for too long on this issue, I mean, the review took a long time to be completed. It was followed by a consultation, of which the report was published in 2020. And to cut a long story short, nothing has yet actually happened, despite the fact that there is wide acceptance and agreement both across government and the sector that something needs to be done, and that ideally the ultimate result of that should be that retention should be ended altogether, and that this will not happen without some sort of government action and indeed legislation that is required.
So your bill, I assume, is an attempt to break the logjam, get things moving again.
That is absolutely right. And it is based on the fact that there is the Construction Leadership Council, which is essentially a government-supported body, agreed at the end of 2019 to endorse a roadmap produced by Build UK towards ending constructions. I mean, actually, the ending retentions. Actually, the roadmap ended to aim to end them in 2023, but with a fallback date of 2025. So there is that general agreement in place that something needs to be done by government, and the government is itself agrees that something needs to be done, but is arguing firstly that there is a lack of consensus, which in my view is inevitable because of the two different views of the situation from
the people retaining the money and the people whose money is being retained.
Absolutely. Yes. There is a sort of fundamental difference of interest there. So, and the purpose of government is to resolve issues like that. Secondly, the complexity of the issue. But I think there are lots of ideas about how you could get from where we are today to where we want to be, which is to ban them altogether. And we can come back to that if you're interested.
Sure.
And thirdly, the difficulty of finding time in the legislative timetable, which I can see is always a challenge. But there are bills, there's the Building Safety Bill already about to come to us, which covers, which is related to this. But I think it would not be impossible if the government had the commitment to do it to find legislative time.
The issue of retention as abuse I think all listeners will know, has been a thorn in the side of the industry for many a year. But there is a role, important role, that withholding retention money has, because it's not always obvious when you have a construction job done, a subcontracting package done. It's not always obvious immediately on completion that the job has been done and completed to satisfaction. And it might take a bit of time. I mean, there is a legitimate reason for retention is to exist. So my understanding is that the consensus that had developed around the way forward was not outright abolition, but the creation of an escrow system. The money is held by a third party in trust. So like in the Carillion example, I mean, this all became hugely hot when Carillion went under, and I can't remember how many millions or billions of retention's money which owed to other people, they never saw it. So the idea that a third party would sit on this money and so they could resolve arguments, I thought that was where the industry was supposed to be heading. But we've had previous bills. I mean, Peter Aldous last year, some MP somewhere in Suffolk, come his constituency, but he piloted a private members bill promoting this middle ground of a retentions deposit scheme. Now, you're going further than that, and this is your own, you're a crossbencher. You're not speaking for the government or any party here. You're an independent peer in the House of Lords, and you're saying, sod the lot of them, we're going full on, let's abolish them, get rid of them. Surely you are less likely to succeed with that than Peter Aldous was with his bill last year, no?
Well, all I'm trying to do is to set an endpoint in line with the... And you're right up to a point about the consensus and the support for a retention deposit scheme, for example. That is where the government is finding all this complexity, is in finding agreement on any given approach to a deposit scheme and ensuring that it is viable financially and in other ways, and that there is also the question of how we get from here to there. But it seems to me there is a wide acceptance that the Build UK roadmap does set a target, which indeed has been mentioned in the past as well, very regularly, and which other countries have approached. How we get there, I would agree with you, Phil, that to go in one leap doesn't seem to me practical, because retentions, after all, have existed for I don't know how many, probably hundreds of years, and are an accepted practice and are built into many contracts. And I have been involved in many discussions of appropriate schemes to ring fence the funding, because the issue is, as you rightly, well, there are several issues, but the main one is perhaps that the funds retained are not in any way protected or ring fenced. And I have seen several schemes, and Peter's bill did go into some detail on retention deposit schemes approach. But the sense I'm getting, at least from those representatives in the industry that I'm hearing from, is that the main issue now is to get something to happen, and putting a legislative endpoint in place would help to promote that. And there are other ways being looked at, as you will know, within the sector, as to how to meet the useful goals of retentions without actually having to take that funding out of the system.
A cynic might say that organisations that represent the main contractors, people like the Construction Leadership Council, Build UK, Civil Engineering Contractors Association, organisations like that, which voice a desire to abolish, you know, obviously Build UK, they've got a roadmap for the abolition of retentions. They all say they want to completely abolish retentions. A cynic might say they know full well the government would never do that. And that, in a way, they're just laying a smokescreen, because they actually would like the whole practice to continue, and that they don't want to be assailed by some attempt to introduce a regulatory scheme that would prevent them being able to use their retained monies for their own, you know, their own use, and that in fact that the abolition of retentions isn't a realistic prospect at all. I mean, have you had any support for your bill from CLC or Build UK?
The main organisation which I have been talking to is Actuate UK, which do represent a very large number of the smaller people.
Forgive me for interrupting. That used to be the Specialist Engineering Council, doesn't it?
It's
familiar. That's what Rudy Klein was involved with, who was a friend of the programme.
And they are certainly engaged with the Construction Leadership Council, for example, and they are supportive of the Build UK roadmap because it does it would reach a conclusion that they would be happy with, although that there are other ways of skinning that cat. But I think more fundamental as well, and why the government needs to be taking an interest, is the sort of pernicious effect that the system has on the building, the construction sector as a whole. And there have been endless reports. I mean, I'm not an expert in this area at all, but I keep finding reports bewailing the fact that the sector is does not work well, that there is a lack of trust between the different players in the sector, that there is insufficient use of technology, that it's inefficient and of poor quality. And I think at a time when we have a huge challenge on the housing front, and at a time when there are very obvious issues that have arisen on building safety as a result of Grenfell, for example, this is actually the right time to look at anything which is failing to promote cooperation and innovation and investment in the sector, and rather, on the other hand, promoting conflict or lack of cooperation between the different players in the sector.
Can I just respond to your question, David, in a different way? I mean, you talk about Build UK as if they are the main contractors group. Well, they are, but they're this strange, unholy alliance. I mean, the chief executive of Build UK, Susanna Nicol, came from the National Specialist Contractors Council. And as it has been told to me, the big tier one contractors saw the work that she was doing for the National Specialist Contractors Council, the subcontractors, one of the subcontractors' bodies, and thought, "Ooh, she's good. We need her to represent our interests." And she said, "Well, I'll sort you lot out, but I'm not abandoning, you know, my NSCC here." And so it became that Build UK is an amalgam of specialist contractors and tier one contractors. So, and all sorts of other things as well thrown in for good measure. So I think it's inaccurate to talk about it as the voice of big construction. And equally, the Construction Leadership Council, it started off as a private dining club where the minister chose his best pet mates who were chief executive of the big contractors and house builders and said, you know, come and have dinner and smoke cigars with me, chaps. And that's been blown open now. I mean, all sorts of people are on there, including, the product manufacturers and trade associations, the FMB I think, did you say Actuate have a seat on there as well, Alistair? I'm not sure, but it's a much wider interest.
Yeah.
But we can't get away from, even though these organisations are diverse, the power is where the money is, and the money's at the top of the chain, which is the big contractors. And so when the big contractors say it shouldn't be done, then it doesn't happen.
I'm sure you're right, but on the other hand, first of all, on this specific issue of retentions, and I wouldn't pretend in any way to be expert on the wider issues of the construction sector, although I'm learning more about them than I perhaps ever expected. but they have, Build UK has pinned its colours to the mast of removing them by 2023, and failing that by 2025. So there is an element of its credibility at stake, and indeed that of the Leadership Council, which again has endorsed that roadmap. And there are these much broader issues at governmental level of getting somehow to a more innovative, efficient, high quality, technologically savvy construction sector. So what I'm trying to do is to build on those needs to address this particular particular part of the overall problem. And I think, you know, the obviously the fate of Carillion brought a lot of focus to the fact that those big firms are maybe making use of retentions funds in a less than acceptable way.
Other people's money, it's the best sort, isn't it?
Absolutely. and you know, if it's being used to keep a business afloat that is not actually as viable as it ought to be, that's extremely worrying. And particularly if that could... if that situation is duplicated in other large contracting companies.
I still wonder, however, if complete abolition is a realistic aim, especially within such a short time scale. We mentioned Rudy Klein earlier. I spoke to Rudy recently about this because he's a big advocate of introducing some sort of scheme to protect retention monies, which he said is a solution which has been used in other jurisdictions all over the world, not just, you know, in Europe or wherever. And he said he knows of only one jurisdiction where retentions have been completely abolished, and that was in New Mexico, in the southern United States. And he says it's completely failed to operate. It just hasn't worked properly. I mean, do you think that we could do it better than New Mexico could do it, or do you think that maybe perhaps if we aim for complete abolition, maybe we can compromise with a scheme instead?
I have very little expectation that my bill is going to become law.
Oh, don't say that. Everyone will switch off now. Talk it up.
I'm a natural pessimist, so I always take a pessimistic view, and I'm then pleasantly surprised when things turn out for the better. But what it will do is create an opportunity for debate and exploration of, hopefully it will, it probably won't be in this session because it's quite a way down the list, but we will keep plugging away, and it will give an opportunity to debate these issues and how do we get there, or in indeed, what other options are there? And now I know government is looking both at a possible ban and at other approaches in the form of protection of retentions funding. And as far as I'm concerned, either of those would be welcome. But I realise also that this bill will not get anywhere unless the government, except that it is designed specifically to promote debate, to put pressure on government, and to encourage them to bring up their own approach. And whether that's a deposit scheme or a ban, I would regard either of those as a successful outcome.
Absolutely.
You say you're a pessimist, but I mean, do you think that the government is making positive noises? Are you fairly confident that they are just going, you know, they're not going to kick the can down the road again? They're going to actually address, you know, grasp the nettle.
Well, I would say they are making positive noises, but whether they're any more positive than they have been since 2015, I'm not sure. I mean, it is on the agenda that they are thinking about the different options, and they are, as you might have seen, when I asked a question, I think it was in January, which the which Lord Callanan answered in the Lords, that the three words that come up in terms of the government's response are complexity, consensus, and legislative time. And they are working on the complexity issue with input from people like Rudy, who, as you say, has done an enormous amount of work in thinking about potential ways of making a retention deposit scheme work both financially and practically. They're also looking at the consensus issue through bodies like the Construction Leadership Council. And I'm not sure how optimistic they are about the legislative time issue. But, yeah, I mean, yes, there is more than just words, but it is taking an awful lot of time to get beyond words to some sort of action. And whether we can be more successful this time round than before, who knows? But as I there are a group of colleagues in the Lords who share my concerns about the issue and who have been involved in questions and other activities in the House. And as you know, there are also MPs in the Commons like Peter Aldous and Debbie Abrahams who are also concerned. So I can't answer your question beyond that. They are making positive noises, but they have been doing so for a long time. And I have no particular reason to think the noises are any more, that we're any closer to action now than we have been for a while.
I was going to speculate whether the whole Grenfell and building safety agenda might have softened the impetus or you know, let some of the air out of the balloon behind contract reform and retentions and so on. But the whole building safety thing is a Ministry of Housing project, whereas retentions and contracts is Business, Energy and Industrial, whatever it is, BEIS, DCI, I still want to call it, but it's not anymore. So they're different government departments. So the building safety agenda shouldn't be having any negative impact on progress in this area, should it?
No, I would have thought, if anything, the opposite, because the Hackett report following the Grenfell disaster specifically mentioned the possible negative impact of retentions on safety issues. I mean, one of the things we will be looking at when the Building Safety Bill comes to the Lords is whether we could put down an amendment relating to retentions in that, which I think the fact that it does appear in the Hackett report gives us quite a good handle, although I wouldn't put money on its outcome.
Yeah, there is a very convincing argument, of course, that you know, any subcontractor that knows it's not going to get paid in full in the foreseeable future is going to cut corners in order to reduce its exposure to cash flow problems. So I can see that there is a serious building safety issue.
And those are the sorts of issues that were mentioned in the Hackett report. One was the negative one of cutting corners and not doing the job properly and using substandard materials. And the other, of course, is inflating the cost of the bid. Although that's probably less attractive because it might make it less likely to be accepted. But either way, neither of those are good results.
Well, it's certainly an issue which I think needs to be resolved. And I think that probably there's a, you say there's a lack of consensus, but I think that most people would agree that, you know, there's a serious endemic problem in the industry here which needs to be addressed. So hopefully, one way or another, that will, you know, sooner or later, we'll get around to addressing it.
What happens next, Alistair? Because before you joined us this morning, David and I were talking about another private member's bill, which has just sort of fallen in the House of Commons, proposing licences for building companies that have to have a mandatory licence to trade. And it's an issue we've talked about before. And the MP who put this forward came to second reading. He made his pitch. The minister stood up and said, "No, we don't like it." And said, "All right, I withdraw." Is that what we expect at second reading? Are you going to stand up at second reading and explain why this is an eminently sensible and necessary proposal? And a government representative is going to say, "Can't be done, too complicated," you know, or "We're doing something else," and you'll withdraw and just come back another day? Or will you put it to the vote?
Well, not at second reading, I won't. What normally happens at second reading is in the Lords anyway, is just a debate on the merits of the bill. And I would hope that a number of the colleagues I mentioned would be able to speak on that. And yes, there would be a reply from the minister. But there are not usually votes at second reading because it would then be referred to committee stage. And then in committee stage, we would go through the bill line by line, which wouldn't take very long.
Because you've only got one line, haven't you? Or two lines,
which is one of the merits of the bill, in my view. And I mean, it depends entirely not on the minister, but on the views of colleagues in the Lords, because debates on private members' bills, they normally take place on Fridays, and there are not a lot of sitting Fridays. As I mentioned earlier, I think it's unlikely that we will even get to second reading in the current session. So we may be looking to a future session before we get to a second reading. And then if we get to second reading, there's a priority list. I mean, and I'm well down in the priority list. So the first thing is to get some time for second reading and then for committee stage. It's not impossible that that the Lords, if we had the time to debate this bill properly, could pass the bill despite whatever response we get from government. But then we have to start the whole process again in the Commons. So the bill itself, as I have said before, it's really a vehicle to press the government in a way to answer the questions you've been asking. When is there finally going to be some movement on this? Because I think part of the consensus, by the way, is that this will only be resolved by legislation. So I think there is a recognition, and indeed by government as well, that they need to take action to resolve the issue. So there is that degree of commitment. It's a question of when it or something like it actually happens.
Well, I'd like to say thank you for joining us, and thank you on behalf of the construction industry for taking up the cause, which is keeping it in the spotlight and keeping the pressure on.
Well, thank you very much. It's been it's not at all something that I would have expected to find myself involved in, but I do think it is, as I said at the beginning, it's an issue of unfairness between different elements of the sector. It's an issue of that is causing damage to the sector and the wider construction situation, and only government can fix it. So those are the things which will continue to lead me to press for something better to happen, to take its place.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. I think it deserves to succeed.
Thank you very much.
First peer of the realm we've had on this pod, isn't it?
It is, yes. First, I'm sure it won't be the last. You know, that topic is a perennial topic of debate, isn't it, in the industry. It'd be nice to actually conclude it one day. I do wish him the best of luck with that bill. I think it deserves to succeed. Anyway, let's move on to more...
Another lost cause.
Well, yes, another... I was thinking of a way of describing it, but that's probably a good... Yes, it is a lost cause, isn't it? I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the fixed link to Northern Ireland.
Yes, indeed. It's been known for some time that Boris Johnson's pipe dream of a fixed link between Scotland and Northern Ireland was not going to happen. He likes these grand projets to float occasionally.
Well, unless it's a third runway at Heathrow, he doesn't like
that. Well, no, he doesn't like that one. But the official report has now been published. It was published last week. And this is all to do with the Network Rail chairman, Sir Peter Hendy, was commissioned to about a year ago to lead a review into how the quality and availability of transport infrastructure across the United Kingdom could be improved to support economic growth and quality of life. A large part of this is, part of it at least, it's levelling up, but it's also trying to physically tie Scotland into England more. I mean, there's an awful lot of, you know, big roads that get to the border and sort of stop, and there's a problem with the M4 upgrade in South Wales was cancelled, which some people thought was great, some people thought was not so great, but there seems to be different bits of the United Kingdom doing different things. And the actual main study that Peter Hendy's come up with, the Union Connectivity Review, is, I'm sure it's terribly important, but it looks like a geography textbook, and therefore it's way out of my head. It's not really saying we should, you know, widen the M1 and double deck the M25, which, you know, as a construction journalist, I was perhaps hoping to get a meaty construction story out of the Connectivity Review. Yeah. It's not really about that. It's about identifying key arteries and movement of goods and things like that. So I don't get very excited about that. However,
as a an addendum, as a separate annex to the main review. He was also asked to look at the feasibility of constructing a fixed transport link, either a bridge or a tunnel, between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, which presumably means Stranraer-Lahn, and that was sort of the bit that was looked at, I think. And this was hived off. Peter Hendy delegated this to a couple of eminent civil engineering professors, Doug Okervey, who made his name in Hong Kong, Chep Lap Kok, I think his project manager there or something, and Gordon Masterton to lead the study. And consulting engineering firms Jacobs and Cowie appointed by the Department of Transport to provide independent engineering expertise. Now, essentially, what the report said, it didn't say can't be done. It said, yeah, we're engineers. You want a bridge? You want a tunnel? We can do that. We can do whatever you want.
Of course.
The problem is that the bridge would cost £335 billion. So that's, you know, judging by what you call it and how you measure it, is three HS2s. Ooh.
At present reckoning, yeah.
Well, HS2 is less than it was now. Incidentally, on the subject of HS2, which we've not mentioned, I'm on your side now. I'm no longer a supporter of HS2. I've come out again it. If it's not going to Leeds, which it's not, there's no bloody point doing it, is the way I see it.
Yeah.
The whole rationale falls down. There was never any idea to spend £50 billion building a high-speed rail line between London and Birmingham to save 10 minutes or add more capacity between London and Birmingham. That's not what we need, folks. So, pointless.
Yeah.
Stupid. No. So, we're now on the same hymn sheet.
Glad you're on side now, Phil.
Two.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, back to this Northern Irish crossing. £335 for a bridge and... £335 billion.
Yeah.
£209 billion. So about £200 billion more than for a tunnel. I mean, it's huge sums of money. Now, admittedly, they're wrapping up into that cost, not just the physical construction of the structures themselves, but also the added railway lines, roads, I think we're all talking railway lines here, that would need to be built to tie it into the network. So it's not just the tunnel that would cost £200 billion. It's a tunnel plus a new line.
The loose ends at either end,
Wherever it would go, Glasgow or Kendal or God knows where.
So
all told, this is what we're talking about. So the summary is that we can do it, but the costs would be impossible to justify today. Anyway, let's see what happens.
Well, yeah. I mean, in a way, it's... You look at what's happened to Northern Ireland following Brexit, and we've got a serious problem there, of course. Northern Ireland is in some sort of limbo between the EU and the UK now. And, you know, we've got this sort of border in the Irish Sea that people talk about. Having a fixed link would solve that. So I can see why people were interested in exploring the idea.
Well, politically, it would send the message that, you know, the government would say, actually, we do care a little bit about Northern Ireland, despite evidence to the contrary.
Yeah.
but not £200 billion.
No, exactly. So, so I can see why they've thrown that one out. It doesn't make sense at all.
But then I still don't understand how come, you know, tiddly little Denmark can build these tunnels and bridges across these virtually uninhabited islands and get it, you know, the crossings that they've got going on over there.
Yeah, but I don't know. Well, I mean, I think they're called the Low Countries for a good reason. I suspect, and I'm no geologist, I suspect that the geology between Scotland and Ireland is rather different from the compared to the geology underneath the the Orison Link or something like that, where you've got shallow seas and presumably fairly uncomplicated ground conditions. I'm just assuming that, but surely I should think that probably knowing the west coast of Scotland, it's going to be pretty rocky and difficult to tunnel through or build bridges over. I guess that's the reason.
They're saying that the tunnel would have to be the longest undersea tunnel ever built. Because if it's going to be a train tunnel, trains can't do really steep hills. So it'd have to start
it'd probably have to start somewhere over on the east coast of Scotland to keep the angle, keep the gradient
Edinburgh, somewhere
nice and gentle. Well, having said that, you know, you're probably easier to get to Edinburgh to start your journey than Larne. That road to Larne, I've done it a few times in the early hours of the morning, trying to dodge rabbits, and it's you kind of think, do I just murder all these bunnies or do I crash the car? So you just pull over and wait for the sun to come up of them all to get out of the way.
Hmm. Well, you know, I suppose it was a nice idea, but it wasn't going anywhere. We already knew that, didn't we?
Well, as Peter Hendy himself said, despite recommending that it's a non-starter, it was an excellent question to ask.
gave him a chance to demonstrate the capabilities of the engineering profession.
Well, it put some cash in the hands of an American and a Danish firm of consulting engineers.
Yeah.
Which we always seem to like to do in this country. Well, there are some British consulting engineers left. But not many.
one or two, couple, I think. So that's it. RIP, the fixed link.
Yes. Hey ho.
So is that it, Phil?
I think it is. We've covered a bit of ground. So are we back again? When are we back next? Next week?
Well, it won't be next week. No, unfortunately not, because we're still fortnightly.
Why's that?
Well, sadly, it's because recording and producing podcasts costs money. Not an awful lot of money, but a certain amount of money, and you can't do it without it. And for that, we need a bit of sponsorship. We do have a few listeners out there. We know what we do. And if they enjoy listening to it, there might be some people amongst them who would like it to continue.
I think the bottom line is that our lords and masters who put bread and water on our table are prepared to bail us out on a fortnightly basis.
Yeah.
But if we're not going to bring home any bacon whatsoever, they're not going to do it weekly. But if someone's prepared to help us out for a loaf of bread and a large glass of water and maybe a slice of bacon to go between the two bits of bread, we'll come back every week. Sure as eggs is eggs.
Oh, get eggs as well.
No, seriously, if anyone is motivated to promote their goods or services to our diverse and educated and enlightened listenership, drop us a line. Well, not David and I, we won't open it because we try to keep our hands off the money, but the appropriate people will see it. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk, or you can find TC Index on various social media places or whatever, but podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Yeah, if you think that you'd like to hear us more often.
Yeah.
Otherwise, 2 weeks' time. It'll be our end of year, our Christmas show. We're going to have a panto.
Well, I might dress up as an elf. I'm not sure I'd go any further than that.
Elf and safety.
You can dress up as safety. Yeah, okay.
Right, no, it'll be our end of year review. If we're not back next week, which is unlikely, it'll be our end of year review, I think, next time round. So we'll see you then. We'll see you then.
Okay.
So for another week, thank you everyone. But it's me, Phil Bishop, and him, David Taylor, saying goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.